You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where we're suing Russia, Ted Wells, and Roger Goodell over the Deflategate conspiracy. I'm your host, Justin Amlesneski, and if you have people to sue over conspiracies, let us know who they are in a five-star review on Amazon, or you can just tell your friend about the conspiracy, and then while talking about that, say, oh, have you heard of Welcome to the Midside? And then we'll get a new listener, and everything will be better for all of us. Joining us on this trip from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards.
I did the most millennial thing I've ever done yesterday.
You gonna tell us what that is?
Oh, I was waiting for you to, you know, be a host. Yes, I'll go ahead and tell you what that is. I participated in our baby shower.
Wait, it's millennial for the father to participate? I'm trying to be PC here. I was going to say husband, but for the father to participate in the baby shower is millennial?
You mean for the birthing partner?
Yeah, the birthing partner. There you go, the birthing partner.
I've heard that phrase about 3,000 times now going to the hospital. Is your birthing partner here? And my Fiza every time says, yes, my husband is here. Love it. So typically men don't participate in the baby shower. It's a very millennial thing that men get invited to the baby shower, usually. It's a woman-only thing, and more and more, as men become women, the men are invited, and I do feel like yesterday, though, I provided a much-needed bartender service, so really, I feel like I had a purpose there other than just being...
I think all the MRAs of the world just got mad at you. The one victory we had was we didn't have to go to the baby shower. Not only did you go to the baby shower, but you took care of the women there and filled their needs. Nice job.
Failing X-Y's one baby shower at a time.
Also joining us this trip from Dale's Lawn, identifying as a woman to forgo his white male gay privilege, William Green.
Hey, it's great to be here.
It's great to have you.
Welcome.
We're trying you out here on a temporary basis. I think it probably will become permanent because James
I hope
left.
Not. I want to keep my penis. I hope not.
Whoa. I do not endorse Lorena Bobbitt or any Lorena Bobbitt-esque activities.
We will make sure, William, that... your transition is smooth.
Oh boy.
You pick
that I just have to point that out, ladies and gentlemen, midsiders out there, that was a very good joke. Transition and smooth. Mm-hmm. Because if you're going from a man to a woman,
I like how
that was a
all
good one.
Humor must be deconstructed on this show. No joke will be left dissected by one Justin M. Lesneski.
I just wanted to point that one out because it had two pieces to it. It had the transition piece, which was funny, but it also had the smooth, which was good as well. That was a very good joke.
What you didn't
that was a very
see, Justin,
joke, if you will.
Was the piece that I cut.
I'm not going to say anything. I'm just going to say what we're not going to cut is everything you say in the next segment, because it's time for the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Center. It really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
For equality's sake, a woman should be the first person on Mars, says a NASA engineer. Yes, we're taking social justice all the way to the red planet. In fact, 12 humans have set foot on planetary body beyond Earth, i.e. the moon. All 12 were men, and Allison McIntyre, who oversees NASA's Space Vehicle Mock-Up Facility in Houston, the home base for astronaut training, said it's only fair that a woman takes humanity's first step on Mars. Quote, "My center director is a woman. My former division chief is a woman. We have female astronauts, but we haven't put a woman on the moon yet, and I think the first person on Mars should be a lady person." She didn't say that. She said woman. Of course, the Apollo missions that landed on the moon all took place before NASA decided to accept female astronauts in 1978. And it was Sally Ride who was the first astronaut to fly in a shuttle, apparently and notoriously, although I did not know this, had to explain that she, quote, wouldn't need 100 tampons for a week in space in 1983. I didn't know that. I mean, I would have assumed, like, what, 50, 60, but not 100. So, Justin, is this simply fighting the patriarchy? And should we mandate that a that a woman be the first person to step foot on Mars?
I think we should because in 100 years, when they take away her holiday and make it National Martians Day or Universal Martians Day, it'll be great. They will finally know. Women will finally know what it feels like.
So to finally be assimilated into the upper class power structure.
Yes, to the point that everyone wants to tear you down and talk about how evil you are. Once they start accomplishing these things. Also, I think we should put them ahead so they can take care of it and they can make the place all neat and tidy for us when we're ready to go colonize it.
That's right. Of course, it's the red planet that we want women to walk on first, right? Yeah. William, patriarchy smashing?
I think this doesn't go far enough. We should find just like we do for government contracts, we should find the one-armed lesbian veteran with multiple mental handicaps in order to fulfill this. We should just go all, like, have an actual Olympics sort of trial to figure out who's the mostest minority-est and only send that person. And then get actually no science done because they won't be able to do anything.
Well, not to belabor the obvious point, but isn't this anti-science to begin with? The idea that using a non-essential criteria to pick someone, isn't that anti-science?
Yes, absolutely. And there is something to be said about, like, how to compose, like, a group that's going to be, you know, millions of miles from Earth, and what that composition should be. Should it be uniform? How should it be composed? Like, there's tons of research on this, like, going back like 50 years. So yeah, that this person works at NASA doesn't mean that they actually know what NASA has actually researched on these topics. So it's completely inessential in the sense that it's picking it for political reason and not for what does the science say, what does the research say, how should this group be made, what kind of people do you need for this group. And, you know, at some point you do have to consider the sex. I mean, you have to consider, because there's different considerations for different sexes, there's different health problems that can occur for different sexes. You know, it's very common for a UTI, for long-term space stuff, and those have different health impacts for men and women. We'll just leave it at that without getting super grossed out. So, you know, that you have to take all those thousands of things into consideration. Marxism should not be a consideration when going to Mars.
Wait. So UTIs are common equally for men and women who space travel for long periods of time?
I'm not going to say the rate is the same between the two, but it is common to get a UTI in space.
I'm assuming
if you're going to get an infection, that's what you're going to get.
Right. This is because of the lack of gravity makes it hard to expel waste, I'm assuming.
I'm not going to speak out of my science realm. I didn't take very many biology classes, but from the things I've read, that is true.
Well, from my knowledge,
Justin, stop speaking out of your urethra.
Yeah.
And let's move on.
Exactly.
I have a penis. I know how I urinate. If I don't have gravity, I know what would happen. So I'm safe to say I'm not stepping outside of my bounds to make that assertion.
There are so many gross jokes, but I'm just not gonna. How about we design the shuttle such that There's a large barn door on the side that gets opened up, and then all the astronauts can hold hands and jump out simultaneously, and we can have every kind of person represented step foot on the moon first, or I'm sorry, Mars first, and then done. Get it all over in one shebang. Even roll up a wheelchair up there. You can all jump out first, and then the shuttle will turn around and leave you there because we don't need social justice idiots. Please stay on Mars. Thank you.
First of all, you found a final use for Mars, right? We're talking about colonizing it. Why don't we just give them a planet and they can start over there?
I don't think they would survive, to be honest. I mean, that's not the kind of people who would want to go there. Think about it. This is typical Marxist SJW sort of mentality, right? It's like they don't want to do this thing. They just want to tell you who should do it or how to do it, right? They just want to tell you you're doing it wrong. It literally doesn't matter to me if it what ethnicity or sex or sexual preference is the first person on Mars. Let's just do it.
I just wanted to send him to Mars to die. That's all I wanted to do.
I don't even care if we do it. Mars has no appeal to me whatsoever. I will never go. I don't care if we go. And if we do go, I hope it's Elon Musk or someone who's not, Elon Musk taking a few subsidies, but I hope it's Jeff Bezos. There we go. And some other guy who's going to sell it for billions of dollars.
Well, that leads into my final question before we move on here. Doesn't the first person who goes to Mars have to be someone who knows how to repair a Tesla?
Change the oil.
Yeah.
Well, there's no oil in a Tesla, but...
That was the joke. Okay. Yeah. No oil whatsoever. Not in any of the... I guess there wouldn't be. You know, I literally had not thought about that.
Yeah, electric direct drive. I mean, they're probably fluids, but...
We've learned a lot of things about fluids on today's episode so far.
Well, moving right along... Bully Hunter's anti-harassment campaign gets shut down as criticism mounts. Bully Hunter's was unveiled last week as a program aimed at combating the harassment and abuse of women in online games. A worthwhile idea that raised eyebrows with its methods. It was billed as, quote, vigilante in-game hit squad, made up of elite women gamers who would, quote, beat bullies at their own game. Basically, players encountering abuse in games were encouraged to contact the bully hunters, who would then send one of their players to infiltrate the game and deliver righteous justice through a righteous ass-kicking. Noble goal, dubious process, and unsurprisingly, it all went about as wrong as it could possibly have. Following allegations of toxic behavior by bully hunters members themselves, and resurfacing tweets by a representative streamer, Natalie Zombie Unicorn Casanova, containing homophobic and abusive language, sponsors and supporters quickly pulled out, and Bully Hunter's website and social media pages went dark, and today the company behind it pulled the plug on the whole darn thing. So, Justin, the Bully Hunters became the bullies in what could only be called the most obvious possible outcome. What say you?
It's exactly correct about how obvious this was. This was somebody who was like, oh, you know, this sounds like a really good idea for a movie premise. What if we made it real? Well, what happens when you try to do things in movies as reality is reality smacks you in the fucking face. And that's what happened here. The idea that they were just going to hijack these games and they were going to be allowed to do that. Did they learn nothing from Gamergate? I mean, this is exactly the same thing. They're trying to push the same social justice agenda through, and the community smacked back at them. How many times do these gamers have to defend themselves before people realize that they're not going to be able to get this through on them? It's just, it's literal insanity at this point. They're living in a fantasy world. I mean, there's a certain irony here, right? They're complaining about the people in video games living in a fantasy world, and they're living in a fantasy world. And then they keep getting the same results for doing the same thing over and over again.
It's almost like if you put power in the hand of power lusters, it doesn't go well.
No.
Who would have, what What events in history could have ever foretold this outcome?
None of them. None of them, Daniel.
William, you're certainly much more in the gamer world than Justin or me. So did you hear about this when it started up?
Yeah. This was absolutely amazingly awful. A train wreck from the beginning. Now, if you're not a gamer, you've probably even heard of it. If you're not a gamer, there's a website like YouTube called Twitch where people stream playing games. And this was heavily marketed as a Twitch event. People joined the Twitch event. If you haven't seen the video, it is so cringeworthy. They actually cut it off early. The event was supposed to last an hour. I think it only lasted 24 minutes. That's how much cringe it was. They had a set. It looked like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, complete with lighting and sound effects. They were trying to say that this was live, but it clearly was not, like, to the point where they're zooming in on some casual female gamer who's not even moving her mouse to play CSGO, which is a first-person shooter game. You move your mouse a lot. They had this, they had bought this zombie unicorn person, whoever that is, a kind of minor league Twitch streamer with social justice leanings. They had somehow roped in a pretty decent sponsor in SteelSeries, but they also had the National Organization of Women and a couple of other sponsors, I think Cyber PC. And this train wreck was just hilarious. And people started, the autism of the internet went at it right away. And they started uncovering that the so-called bully and the person being bullied are the same Steam user. It's just the usernames. You can look at their history and see that they changed their username. And the male voice that was supposedly being the bully, saying all the ridiculous things that were said on the stream, was the same person in both their, like, hey, here's an example, and, oh, we're interrupting the middle of the broadcast to see a bully hunt live. It was the same male actor playing both voices. It was just a train wreck. So this happened a week ago Friday now. By Friday night, that person's Twitter and Twitch were blowing up. If you look at the Twitch, like, you can chat in Twitch, the amount of, like, penises and Pepe memes in the Twitch chat was off the charts during the live broadcast. A lot of YouTubers have done game footage of this train wreck, just breaking it down. The sponsors left pretty quickly. It sounds like nobody really knew what these guys were doing. They approached with one sort of idea of, like, an anti-bullying campaign, which there's, like, an international anti-bullying, like, UN sort of holiday coming up, and a lot of gaming companies do something for that. And I think people kind of thought this was going to be one of those things, but what it turned into was something so much more spectacularly awful and entertaining.
Well, it sounds delightfully train wrecky, and it couldn't have happened to a worse group of people.
I have a question for you guys based upon the description of the story and based upon everything William just said. And it's a broader cultural question. So something like this is trying to mask itself as spontaneous, that there's just a group of people coming in here calling themselves the bully hunters who are going to protect the unjust. Like I said, like a movie. But it's like we've seen in the movies recently, especially with Disney, with Marvel and Star Wars, where they're hopping on this social justice train as a excuse for marketing to get more notoriety and to get more acceptance of their virtue, for people to like them because they're being virtuous, right? It's a way of virtue signaling. And even this seems like a marketing company's attempt to jump on the social justice bandwagon. So my question for you guys is, how much of this social justice stuff has ever been a legitimate grassroots movement? And how much of it has been companies propping it up as an excuse to get visibility?
Certainly some percentage of it is that. I think more of it will be that as companies see that it's a profitable venture, or at least the veneer of it seems to be a profitable venture. But I don't, there's not a lot of companies, you know, other than the sort of like top secret Illuminati-esque companies who are like leading trends out there. I mean, some do, obviously, but like most just respond to trends. Most see an opportunity to sell something based on what's going on in the culture. So unfortunately, Justin, I think a significant percentage, if not damn near all of it, is an actual result of the Marxist collectivist culture, especially of our universities, but of American culture, womp, youth culture as a whole. So, yeah.
William, you agree with that?
Yeah, I think I think that there's some sense that this is coming from academia and sort of the indoctrination train, right? But I think also there's probably a little bit connected to, at least earlier on, a little bit connected to like rebellion against like the status quo. And so you get this kind of interesting mixture now, right? I mean, that sort of explains also the rise of the alt-right, right? You've got this mixture of like pushing against the what people perceive as the power structure now. So, yeah, I think I pretty much
agree. Yeah, that's interesting, and that's something I will track going forward with in what you just said. The idea of using especially the youth's desire to rebel against the status quo or the power structure. That's definitely been hijacked by both of those movements, the alt-right and the social justice movement. So I think that's worth tracking going forward.
Well, speaking of hijacking movements or something or other, Representative Keith Ellison, who is the Democratic National Committee vice chairman, speaking at a progressive training session last week, said that the Democratic Party needs to start winning at the ballot box because, quote, women are dying because we are losing elections. Period. He didn't mean it metaphorically, unfortunately, for Ellison. He said, we don't have the right to lose a damn election. We have to win. We have to win. Women are dying because we are losing elections. He apparently was referring to the maternal mortality rate, although, interestingly, this article says the maternal morality rate.
Zero.
Well, which is not correct.
Yeah, that's also very low.
The mortality rate is rising in states like Missouri and Texas, Ellison said. The United States has one of the highest rates of maternal deaths among wealthy and developed countries. In 2013, there were 28 maternal deaths per 100,000 in the United States. Missouri has one of the highest maternal death rates in the nation with 19.9 deaths per 100,000. The rates are on par with countries like Belize and countries like Moldova and Costa Rica. Here's where it gets interesting, because you have this whole Ellison saying women are dying because we're losing elections, which is supposed to link it to Republicans, which is supposed to link it to healthcare, maybe, I guess, or unless Republicans are literally killing women, which he might be saying. But the leading causes of maternal death, in Missouri at least,
abortion,
are all cardiac related, oh, by the way. No, Justin, thank you. And it's the state's, it's because the state has a really high rate of smoking and obesity, which way worsen the complications of pregnancy. In fact, one of the things we've been coached up on so much during Fiza's pregnancy is, you know, increased appetite, but don't eat poorly, because the last thing you want to actually do is gain bad weight during pregnancy, because obesity just complicates the hells out of things, as the kids say, and you don't want to do that. So, Justin, on a scale of Pinocchio to Bill Clinton, how disingenuous is the statement that women are dying because we're losing elections?
I can't figure out which side of the scale is the worst scale. Is the worst side? I mean, I think they're pretty equal with bad liars, aren't they?
The point being, you can just put it anywhere on that spectrum. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
this is what they do all the time. And this is maybe a reductio ad absurdum of the way they do things. But it's just always this like, oh, if we say this absurd thing and we link it to the other side, it'll make them seem evil and it'll make us seem good. Like, even as you were explaining it, I was waiting for you to explain how Democrats/progressives not winning elections leads to women dying. And there's not even really a link. It's just, they literally say, if you don't vote for us, women will die. This is something South Park made fun of a long time ago, and I may have referenced it on the show recently, but I've definitely referenced it many times in my life. It's when they did the whole anti-Harbucks, which was a stand-in for Starbucks ad, and they had the kids, the South Park kids, go on, and then it said, you know, vote against Harbucks or you hate kids. You don't hate kids, do you? That's all this is. It's just, it's absurd. There's no validity to this. There's no truth to it. And it, again, goes to the issues I always talk about. Nobody wants to talk about what it really matters. And it's about self-responsibility and taking care of yourself. And I mean, Daniel, you're saying, you know, self-responsibility as far as, you know, you don't want to gain unhealthy weight when you're pregnant. But let me ask you this. Now, I don't know, and you probably have more information about this than me, but just from a specious standpoint, wouldn't you not want to eat unhealthy because that would be the first nutrients your child is receiving? So if you're only eating McDonald's, isn't that going to be the nutrients, the nutrition your baby is receiving?
Yeah, there's obviously that. You don't want to start your child off poorly by eating a bunch of sugar and junk food, and mothers who eat poorly make it so that their child has a greater chance of being obese into adulthood, greater chance of diabetes into adulthood, etc., or even childhood diabetes in some cases, of really poor health.
Right, so we talk about fetal alcohol syndrome, but we don't talk about like fetal diabetes syndrome, intentionally mispronounced.
Actually, they do. There is fetal diabetes. It is something you can get.
Well, we should talk about it more. That's my point. Yeah. And we should talk about terrible mother syndrome, even when they're pregnant. Terrible human being syndrome. Can we talk about that for a minute rather than just trying to blame it on an election and a political party?
Well, your point is well taken, but the sort of meta point is you can't even get to that point if the mother dies during childbirth, and then either the child dies too or there's no mother. And it's because obesity really complicates things. It makes it very difficult for many reasons.
That is the worst case of child abandonment. That is the worst case. If your mother is so unhealthy that she dies while giving birth to you, that is the most traumatic way you could be abandoned as a child.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. William, my question for you is, if we take the logical inverse of what Mr. Ellison is saying, are Democrats promising immortality for women if they're elected?
I was going to say that.
I think he might be. I think, though, this is one of the most, to kind of take a card out of Justin's projection playbook, isn't this just projection? Isn't this what they want, the kind of power these politicians want? This is what they want to happen. They want to be able to have so much power that they can control the infant mortality rate and the mother childbirth mortality rates, right? Like they really do see that world as what they want to live in. And it's, to me, it's kind of scary, right? Like these people, this is clearly a fear tactic, right? But they want to live in that world where politicians have those kinds of power over people. This is something, I just finished Steven Pinker's book, Enlightenment Now, and this is something that struck me. It's a great book, by the way, but there's one idea that he just does not get throughout the entire book that solves a lot of the sort of problems I see with his book, and that's people look to government for the answer, right? Like they think that when something is wrong, the first place to go to fix that societal ill is government, and that's not correct. And it's the same thing here. The first place you look when you see that that Missouri and Texas have a low infant mortality rate or whatever healthcare system you're looking at, the government is probably not the first place you should look. There's probably other places that you can look to figure out how to solve that problem.
Yeah, like what the mother is eating during pregnancy. You don't need a giant government apparatus to put down the hamburger and pick up some kale. Like, it's not – you don't need massive government entitlement programs, spending, or a police state in order for women to decide that instead of eating a bowl full of peanut M&Ms and Cheetos, they're going to have some friggin' fruit and vegetables. It's really not that difficult. If you're not that responsible – if you are not responsible enough to make that basic kind of decision when you are bringing another human being into the world, then you are certainly not worthy of our help. I'm sorry, you're not. And it sucks for your child that they're coming into the world with a horrible mother who makes terrible decisions. But if you can't make the most basic decisions, I'm talking about here if I even acknowledge the concept of a social safety net, which I don't think I do, but let's say I did. This person would fall through it or break it with their obesity or whatever it is because they don't deserve our help because they don't make basic good decisions about what to do with their life.
Can I build off of what you just said?
my concluding point is, if you're going to decide to help people with government, if you're going to decide that there must be a safety net, that it must be legitimately people who deserve to be helped, who are in this position for no fault of their own whatsoever, and who have fallen through every other layer of protection, fine. If we want to get to that level, I'll take that level of government, call it a day, retire, go sell booze or be a bartender somewhere or whatever, and stop fighting for freedom. But until that point, no, you don't deserve our help. Okay, please build.
I think there's a deeper point about deserving here. And I want to talk to all of the men out there for a second. Okay? Men, if you see a woman who only eats bowls of Cheetos and peanut butter M&Ms, at what point do you sit there and go, you know what? That's who I want to stick my dick in. I think she'd be a really good mother. What about the men who are deciding to impregnate these women? That's an issue too.
Agreed. Yes, totally. 100%. It is flaws. It's flaws all the way down, Justin. It's just flaw on top of flaw on top of flaw. And it's why, as William was saying, there is no amount of government that can fix this problem. It's not possible, because it's a cultural problem. It's a philosophical problem. It's a psychological problem. It's problems on top of problems, problems for days. People need to learn from the lobster. Dr. Jordan Peterson.
So in summary, chaos versus order and lobsters.
Look at the solution, though. The solution is clearly single-payer healthcare. Here we come. Yes. Here we come, Canada. Hi, Mark from Canada.
I thought the solution was avocado toast for everyone.
The solution is to obviously take more responsibility away from people in their lives and give it more to the government. There is a really basic managerial phrase bordering on cliche at this point, which is, if you want people to take responsibility, you have to give them situations in which they take responsibility. The more responsibility you take away from people, the less responsibility they will take overall, in other words. So, yeah, let's nationalize healthcare so that it's not just one giant bowl of Cheetos and peanut M&Ms, but it's two, maybe covered in whipped cream or some shit. And then, who cares? I've got free healthcare forever from the government. What responsibility do I have to take for my life, et cetera?
Yeah.
Man, I didn't know I was going to be the hardcore, horrible libertarian on this.
Man.
Hello, I just like to make fun of dudes for fucking fat chicks.
Well, if I got a story for you. Speaking of dead women, Barbara Bush.
Yes. Love the transition. I love it.
A professor from Fresno State. Is it a university or is it just a collection of buildings? I'm not sure. From Fresno State.
False dichotomy, bro.
Rhonda Jarrar said that Barbara Bush was, quote, an amazing racist. Yes, in a tweet. And it caused a lot of, I don't know, outrage on the Twitters and whatnot. But the professor is not backing down. In fact, she's doubling down on her tweets, basically taunting her opponents because she's tenured and said she will never be fired. She wrote in another tweet, "I'm happy the witch is dead. Can't wait for the rest of her family to fall to their demise the way 1.5 million Iraqis have. Bye." Period. She put a period after bye. Very good. Of course, the university is backed away from her words, and people are not supporting her, but she's basically claiming absolute universal free speech rights. So, Justin, this is an interesting question. Is it conservative or sort of right-wing snowflakeism that's responding to this professor and calling for her to be fired? Is it a matter of free speech in this issue?
Fresno State is a public university, correct?
I didn't know it was a university.
Yeah, I think it's a California State University.
Yeah, and what does she teach?
She teaches feminism. She teaches writing or some horrible English department.
Oh, that's right. And I was like, this is why no one in this country knows how to write or read, because these people.
Yes, bye.
Yes. That's the thing, is it's ultimately the whole integrated life issue. And not to go all like Platonic or Aristotelian, or someone can correct me over this, but
I will. Don't worry.
what point did we stop this idea that people who teach need to have wisdom? There's no wisdom anymore. And what I mean by that is it's not just about having a supposed expertise in a subject matter. The best teachers, the professors, should have wisdom about life as well, to the point that they have an integrated life, that they don't go online and tweet this stuff. But to connect this to the last story, the headline of this might as well be obese woman uses social media to get attention she otherwise couldn't. Nothing to see here. This is normal. Move on with our lives. That's all this is. That is all this is. But the question is, why would the university want to hire somebody like that to teach? That's probably a market issue. I mean, first of all, it's in California. But second of all, that's what's being churned out by the universities to teach English.
Yeah.
Yeah.
William, that's really my question to you is, should we not fire her for the tweet, but instead fire her because she's horrible at her job?
I think if you're going to fire her for anything, fire because she's horrible at her job. I think, just to kind of connect back to Justin's point, how many news stories would not exist without it being just a blanket copy paste from Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook? And
indeed,
there's no extra digging going on in this story at all, right? All you see is what people tweeted about a tweet. There's nothing saying like, hey, is this actually a good professor? Is she trying to make a point here? Is she on, you know, like what's going on? Like there's none of that. This is just, look, a controversy. Wouldn't you like to read a story about it where we link all the tweets in one page for your convenience?
Right, right, 100%. And to sort of use that to circle back to the wisdom point, I want to expand the wisdom outward. And this goes, again, back to the last story. We need to re-enter into this conversation being a good person. We need to start asking, again, culturally, what it means to be a good person and how it means to conduct your life as somebody who is a good person. I would say somebody who has this job and is of this age, yet still acts in this way, is not being a good person. And that needs to be what's discussed if this story is discussed. But we have this whole non-judgmental thing, this whole social justice thing where we can't body shame her. We can't say anything about what she believes. So she can just continue to be a terrible person. If we could shame her a little bit in some way, she wouldn't have ended up like this.
Yeah, I think this is, as much as we've harped on this being a non-story, like, it looks like she's taken her account private. She's probably learned her lesson about being this crash. I don't think it should affect her job. Lord knows I say offensive things on Twitter all the time. you know, I don't want to lose my job here on this show. I just got it today. So, you know, there's an amount of separation, right? People should make their own judgments. If you're a student here or an alumni here, you should probably have a lot more to say about this person than I do, right? I don't care. She's just some random public person, right? Just someone out on the street, just like the 15 homeless people I cross in Santa Monica when I try to get to work every day, right? Rambling things into the void.
Only 15? That's
all this is to me. Well, the parking structure is thankfully very close to my work.
One parking structure, 15 homeless people.
I agree that I typically am a free speech absolutist in this regard. I do get tired, though, you know, repeatedly protecting the free speech rights of people on the right who are expressing a legitimate opinion that I don't agree with, and then protecting the free speech rights of people on the left who are calling people names. It gets really tiring, and sometimes there's a switch. I don't mean to say that those are exclusively how those things work, but it is the vast majority of the time that people want to shut down people on the right because they have opinions they don't agree with, and the right wants to shut down people on the left because they're calling names, and while neither should be shut down, I do get really tired of protecting the name calling. So if just once or twice, you know, a year, the left could come up with some interesting arguments that I'm protecting that the right wants to shut down, I'd be into that. I wouldn't be opposed to that, people on the left. You could just stop calling people names for 10 minutes and have, I don't know, a thought. That would be interesting.
And also, by now, aren't we all racist? I mean, I think we should keep a list of who is not racist.
It would be a short list.
Yeah. Is there any historical figure that is not racist?
Martin Luther King Jr.
No, he was racist. He believed you should be judged by your content of your character, not the color of your
that's
skin.
That's right.
That is actually called racist now. Yeah.
Oh, I forgot. How about that David Hogg kid? He wants to ban guns. He might be not a racist for the next 12 minutes.
Ooh. Yeah, he's not quite historical yet.
Yeah, that's right.
That's racist, defining who's historical and who's not historical. We are all historical from the moment we're born, because the moment we're born is immediately in the past and therefore is history, William.
Oh, man.
Yeah, William. Get schooled on time.
All right, you guys want to talk about other things that don't make any sense?
Not really,
sure.
But okay.
We're going to do that in The Hopeful Romantic with JML.
Focused on.
Well, guys, I did it.
You had sex for the first time?
Wow.
Are we now time traveling? No, I did something that if I was still a virgin, it would make me never want to have sex again.
Oh.
I saw an Amy Schumer movie.
Oh, no.
Wow.
So, last episode, I saw a Tyler Perry movie. This episode, I saw an Amy Schumer movie. I went and I saw I Feel Pretty. If you remember, I did tackle this on Trailer Takedown. I did have major objections to it. But my girlfriend...
Are you on like a self-flagellation tour or something?
Well, no, last week...
What did you do to your girlfriend to make her take you to these terrible movies?
It's more, what did society do to her because she grew up in Los Angeles? No, last week I legitimately wanted to see Henson in that movie. I think she's a good actress. I wanted... her to succeed, and I've never seen a Tyler Perry movie, so I sort of wanted to experience it firsthand. Likewise, I've never actually seen an Amy Schumer movie, so sort of wanted to experience it firsthand. But no, yeah, it was my girlfriend who wanted to see it, so I went and I saw this movie. And you guys have all seen the controversy around this movie, correct?
Amy Schumer's
no.
fat or not? Is that the
yeah? The controversy is they're saying Amy Schumer is actually not social justice enough because she's body shaming by making it seem like her body is unattractive, whereas you know the typical model is what's attractive and what all women aspire to be. So they're saying the
so
premise
she's not hideous enough to take the position that.
Hold on, pause
understand.
The phone. Pause. We're saying that Amy Schumer is not hideous enough.
Yes.
Okay. Oh, my. Interesting.
Yes, because a lot of the movie is purporting to be about self-esteem. It's the whole idea that she doesn't think she's attractive, even though she is. So once she learns to believe in herself, good things start happening to her. That's the whole premise of the movie. They actually even... reference Big in this movie. If you remember, Big is the Tom Hanks movie where the kid wishes to be an adult and he wakes up the next day and he's adult after consulting Zoltar. Well, they show that scene and then Amy Schumer goes out into a fountain when it's raining and she throws a coin and wishes to be beautiful. She wants to be undeniably pretty. So then the next day at SoulCycle, she falls off the bike, talked about that already, hits her head, and she sees herself in the mirror and she hasn't changed at all, but she suddenly believes she's undeniably attractive and starts acting that way. Now, what else happens in the movie is she gets hired as a receptionist at this high-end cosmetic company that's trying to make a brand of cosmetics for normal and average women, which the movie is leading us to believe that she actually is. She ends up becoming influential in the company with teaching them how to create and market this to average women. Then she hits her head again and loses all her confidence because she looks in the mirror and doesn't believe she's undeniably attractive. This is where the movie falls apart even more. And it's in the climax. And it falls apart two ways. Now, as opposed to Tyler Perry's movie last week, Acrimony, I want to be very clear. This movie does have a level of production value. You don't watch this and think it's amateur. You watch this, you go, this is a professional movie. But the writing and production is so formulaic. So at the end, they have to give this big presentation at the launch of this cosmetic line. And she has realized that the only thing holding her back after she re-hits her head and doesn't believe in herself anymore is that she needs to do this because no one else is capable. So she writes the speech and goes to deliver it. And at the beginning of the speech, she goes, "Most of you know me as this." And it's a picture of her as the receptionist when she believed she was attractive. And then she puts up another picture and says, "But everyone else knows me as this. This is what I'm really like." And it's a picture of before she believed she was attractive. And she turns around and she looks at both the pictures and she realizes they're the same. And she has this big epiphany. But it's like my girlfriend said to me, after the movie, she goes, "If she put that presentation together, wouldn't she have seen the two pictures next to each other to begin with and already realized they were the same?" So writing-wise, they just had her have an epiphany because that's the moment in the movie where she has to have the epiphany to say the theme. It wasn't earned. It was poorly executed. But then the problem was the epiphany. So if you think about the wish is she wants to be undeniably attractive, and then she just wakes up the next day and she hits her head and she believes she's undeniably attractive. Now, what has she not done, Daniel? I know this is right up your alley. What has she not done to become attractive?
Work on herself.
100%. There is nothing in this movie about you have to earn being attractive. You have to earn being a good person. You have to earn self-esteem. I mean, it even starts with her trying to go to these SoulCycle classes, and rather than, you know, get in shape at SoulCycle like people do, she hits her head, and that's how she becomes to believe she has self-esteem. And even in the final speech, it says that. She just sits there and she's like, "Well, why does no one love me just because I am me? I am a good person. People should love me, and I love me because I am me." So for the sole fact of existing, she wants to be loved, and that's why she feels pretty, and that's why she feels good at the end. And that's the point. So the point becomes, at the end of this movie, just a rehash of the old self-esteem movement, which was really just narcissism in hiding.
Is this the James Taggart story?
Jeez. In very many ways it is. Very, very many ways it is. And because, well, Justin, I say that... go ahead, William.
Oh, I was going to move on to something else. So go ahead, finish that up.
Yeah. As I was watching this, I go, if a movie like this was made from a beta male perspective, where he, you know, hits his head and suddenly believes he's super hot, and then he starts working, and all of these, you know, male models become friends with him, and then at a certain point, the hot sister of the owner of the VP of the company starts coming on to him just because he's confident all of a sudden, they would be like, "This is a beta male fantasy. This is disgusting. They would say that it's oppressive." But because it's a woman making this movie, suddenly it's okay. Suddenly the super hot guy is going to be into her just because she's attractive. He does this super hot guy who's supposed to be this alpha guy does all of these like beta moves to get her attention too. He's like, "Oh, the room service is blocked in my room. Can I come in your room and order room service?" And it's like, really? Really? So this is a complete fantasy. You know how they throw around terms like Mary Sue for when guys do stuff like this? Well, that's exactly what this movie is, but none of that is talked about. They just say it's body shaming.
Yeah, I was going to connect this with a question I really have for you, Justin. So this really connects. You look at how, like, you know, Rian Johnson and J.J. Abrams and like from what you described with this film, are we really seeing just a return to like classicism, like a classicism, sorry, like where you just paint by the numbers, right? There's certain beats that happen at certain times, and you don't have to bother with integrating the plot or the character development. Just as long as you hit those certain things, then you can make a movie and people go see it.
100%. What that is when you have very poorly educated consumers and poorly educated writers, it's very concrete bound production and concrete bound writing. There's no paying attention to the theme, which should be the integrating element of any story. Instead, it's what you just said. It's you hit the certain beats and that's the end of it. This goes back to the book, Save the Cat, The idea being, in the first scene, if you have the hero do something good, that's how you establish him as the hero. Oh, if a hero saves a cat in the first scene, everyone knows that's the good guy in the story. That's why many of these action stories start with good versus evil, and you see the good guy save the day.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense.
So, yeah, why you should see this movie? I mean, I guess if your girlfriend wants to see it, go see it. Otherwise, see it if you want to have firsthand evidence of what's wrong with the whole Amy Schumer thing, that ultimately she's rooted in narcissism, which shouldn't be a surprise to anyone that she is a narcissist. Why you shouldn't see it? Because there's a lot of other stuff worth seeing in theaters right now, even if you're just curious about it. I mean, A Quiet Place is like killing it at the box office, even though it looks ridiculous. Could check that out to see what it's worth. I still want to see Rampage. I still want to see Blockers. So I just wouldn't recommend this movie at all. I mean, I guess if you have a choice between Acrimony and this, the production value is at least better. Although the performances aren't as better. I will say this about Schumer as an actress. Something that was very noticeable was everyone else was carrying the scenes. I kept noticing that the reactions to her were much better performances than her actual performance. So let's move on and talk about what's going to come out. And actually, we're going to talk about another movie that has forced feminism in it. That's the last one, though. So let's just move on here.
Trailer takedown. First trailer.
Anon is a Netflix original movie. In it, it looks like people's vision is able to be hacked into. I don't know if they create a computer interface or not. It's not very clear. There's some dialogue in the trailer where it's like people have figured out how to hack into your eyes and like erase your images or change the images you're seeing. And in it, there's a woman who is the best hacker of all, and they need to get her to help them because somebody is hacking the main cop's vision and fucking things up for him. Like at one point near the end of the trailer, it says the road is clear, but his vision tells him the road is clear, but actually there's a lot of cars and he drives into it and gets hit a lot. And then they start saying, well, anonymity is bad because if you can completely erase someone, they become anonymous. And that's what this woman's doing. She's making herself anonymous. Just as with my description, this seemed very, very, very unfocused to me. I do appreciate that Netflix is getting these movies that seem to have a lot of star power and high production value, and they seem to be caring about unique premises, but none of this stuff seems to make any sense. It's sort of like the one with Alexander Skarsgård where he couldn't talk at all. It's like, okay, so this one's about your vision can be fucked with, they can change what you're seeing, and that one's about someone who can't speak and is a cop. Okay? That's a premise. That's not a theme. As William was just pointing out, we need themes. Tackle. Daniel?
All I could think of was a non-what. And apparently it's a non-story.
Oh, that was good.
I don't really get it. I mean, there's something interesting in the notions here, but it was so, I think the word nailed it, which is unfocused. It's so unfocused that I don't have any interest. I'm not, contrary to what I've, all that, I'm going to sort of reluctantly, mildly hug it.
Hug?
For now, in the sense that I think there's enough interesting there that I will wait for another trailer, and maybe a second or third trailer will draw out something more interesting in this, but it's only a tentative, light, reluctant hug.
Well, ironic that it's unfocused when it's about vision, right?
Yeah, totally.
Also, not to say South Park did it again in this episode, but this reminds me of the episode of South Park from this recent season where it's Netflix headquarters and they're calling. People keep calling them and they go, "Hello, Netflix, you're greenlit. Hello, Netflix, you're greenlit." Somebody keeps going in with these premises and these pitches. What if there's a world where vision could be hacked and they could change what you're seeing? And there's one woman who's so good, she's made herself anonymous. And they're like, sold. Make that movie.
Yeah.
William?
Maybe I'm reading more into this than you guys are. I agree the trailer was pretty unfocused. But I saw this as using vision as an allegory for anonymity in society. And what, like, if this theme is developed in the further trailers about, like, this concept of like how anonymity can, you know, can be a challenge and a good part of society. I think it'd be really interesting to explore. So I'm hugging it.
Hug.
Can you explain how Vision is an allegory for anonymity?
I can't after watching this trailer, that's for sure.
Okay, so I think based upon that response, you would be reading into it. I hope you're right. I want to be clear about that. I don't want to seem like I'm shitting on your point. I hope you're right. I 100% hope what you just said is true, because the cast is good, the production value looks good, the directing doesn't look boring, and if that's the theme, I'm in. I just don't think there's evidence
in there. I have to grasp at straws here. I am sci-fi starved. I know the Expanse just started up last week, and I'm already super excited for that. But literally, Orville and Expanse, that's it. That's all we have for good sci-fi. Star Trek Discovery is one giant social justice warrior stick up your ass the entire time. You can't watch it. It's just unwatchable. And Orville, we have an interesting mixture with new IP and trying to mix comedy with actually telling good sci-fi stories, which it's, I know we disagree on this, but I think they're doing a pretty good job. Hopefully they can find their, certainly better than the first season of Star Trek TNG on just your normal sci-fi scale. But The Expanse, one of the best sci-fis on television, maybe one of the top sci-fi TV shows of all time, you know, just started season 3, but we have nothing else. There's nothing else out there. So I want to see if this is going to help turn the sci-fi genre back around into doing something interesting again, and this looks interesting, but I'm hugging it.
I love your optimism. I love it so much, and I also agree about sci-fi being a particular example of what I'm about to say. I think that we're starved in general, and that is why I'm not as forgiving of trailers anymore. We watch all of these trailers every week, and all of this content is being churned out, but I find myself watching things recently, and I'm just like, why am I watching these things again? Like, Daniel, you guys reviewed Roseanne on here, and Midsider Alfred has reached out to me about it, and I watched like 3 episodes of it, and I'm in the 3rd episode, and I'm like, why am I watching this? Like, it's not terrible, but it's also not great either. And it's just like, this is what I'm choosing to do with my limited time. All right. Well, let's use your limited time better. Let's move on.
Second trailer.
Hotel Artemis is a movie about a hospital for, I don't know why I just said is a movie. Obviously it's a movie. No shit, Justin. Good job. You're such a great host. Hotel Artemis is about a hospital that's called a hotel, but it's for criminals. I think it's the year 2028. I believe I read that in the synopsis. And in this hotel, the only reason it has continued to work is because there are a set of rules that Jodie Foster enforces with a really weird accent and a badass Dave Bautista backing her up. What happens is a couple criminals come in and they have some sort of magic stick that's worth like $128 billion or some amount. And other criminals come in and they tell Jodie Foster, hey, we're not going to follow your rules anymore because following them is what is going to stop us from getting that thing. And actually, I will say this. That character played by Jeff Goldblum makes a really good point, which kind of blows up the entire premise of the movie. So maybe it's lantern hanging. But Jeff Goldblum's character says to Jodie Foster's character, and I'm paraphrasing here, so you want us to follow the rules in a hotel that's made its money off of people who don't follow the rules. And it's like, yeah, this entire movie just fell apart. I will say this. It's written and directed by one of the co-writers of Iron Man 3. And it does have a good visual look to it. I like how it looks. So it's not like I was off-put by it. The longer I watched the trailer, the more I was like, hey, this is interesting. This is at least creative. It's not trying to be real. It's trying to just be what it is. And I appreciated that. Still, though, tackle. Daniel?
I wonder if I'm going to play the middle of the rotor on all of these this week, because I had, God, a damn near similar reaction to you, except it just crossed the point into like mild hug territory, which is premise. Boo, don't care, stupid, did it in John Wick, essentially. Didn't need a whole movie about it. And then, like, people were added, like, Jodie Foster was added, and I was like, oh, that's an interesting choice. And then Jeff Goldblum shows up. I love Jeff Goldblum. Watch anything with Jeff Goldblum in it. And then, just as the trailer went, I just found myself going, oh, okay, well, I could see this. This is interesting. So, light hug.
Hug.
So, if you will see anything with Jeff Goldblum in it, have you seen Thor Ragnarok?
Okay, minus Marvel movies.
William?
I thought that went without saying, by the
way. I unfortunately have seen Thor Ragnarok. I am going to tentatively hug this. I feel like this premise has been played out, but we could get an interesting performance from Jodie Foster or Goldblum, so I'm going to see another trailer, but for now, tentative hug.
Hug?
Okay, here's the thing. When I was watching that Jodie Foster performance, I feel like they gave her the role, and then she came in the first day and did that weird accent and everything, and the director was like, that's not in the script. What are you doing? And she's like, that's my interpretation of this character. And he was like, eh, fuck it, go with it. That's what it felt like. I mean, now granted, you only see a small snippet of her in the trailer, but if she's been living in Los Angeles for all of these years, and it's the year 2028, why would she have that accent and act in that way?
Maybe Texas took over California. Who knows?
I love how this week is just William writing his own backstories in for these trailers.
Got to make them interesting somehow.
Yeah, that's right. I'm so starved for good content. I have to make up my own.
Well, I'm interested to see how you're going to do that for this last one.
Final trailer.
Mary Shelley is the dramatic retelling of the story of Mary Shelley's life. In it, she meets Percy Shelley. She meets another guy who tries to get her to cheat on Percy Shelley. Then she writes Frankenstein, even though nobody believes that she can write Frankenstein. Then the trailer puts up a bunch of stuff about how this is a feminist masterpiece, and I get really mad. And I turn into Frankenstein's monster, and I tackle it.
Tackle.
Here's the thing. I know I already tackled it, but there's two things about this trailer that really annoy me. One, can we stop making movies about the artists behind great pieces of art? I mean, we did this with Winnie the Pooh, and I believe we did this with Charles Dickens as well. And it was like, look at all the trouble Charles Dickens had writing A Christmas Carol. Nobody gives a shit. They want to read A Christmas Carol or watch Patrick Stewart do a one-man show of it or watch the Muppet version of it. Nobody cares. Just like the same thing with Winnie the Pooh. I think we've had two movies about behind the scenes of Winnie the Pooh. There was the one that was the super dramatic one, and then there's a new one coming out with Ewan McGregor in it. Just nobody cares. They like Winnie the Pooh. They don't care about A.A. Milne or whatever the fuck his name is. It's the same thing here. Nobody cares about the marriage of the Shelleys. They really don't. The only marriage involving a Shelley they care about is if Sheldon eventually gets married to, what's her name? Amy Farrah Fowler. That's the only Shelley people care about getting married. And then, can we also stop this? Just make a movie because it's a woman doing a great thing? Hey, look at this. A woman wrote a great book. Let's make it a triumph of feminism because a woman did something great. One woman doing something great does not mean all women are great and does not mean it's a win for all women. It just means that one woman did something great. And good for her. She wrote a great book. It's a master of gothic fiction. But we don't need a whole fucking movie about it. The end. Go ahead, Daniel.
Well, well, well. I'm not that down on it, but I am down on it. The point that I will make along a similar line is I'd be so much more into this movie if I didn't get splashed on the screen 1,000 times that it's a feminist masterpiece. It's a statement for women in the era of Me Too. It's important, more important than ever to see movies like this. It's like, shut the fuck up. Just show me a good movie. I don't care if it's about a woman. I don't care if it's about a man. Just show me a good movie. I'll go watch it. I might be into this movie if you didn't dress it up in your nonsense propaganda. Tackle.
Tackle!
I'd like to announce our new documentary, Midside exclusive, Behind the Midside, focusing on the love life of Justin. It's going to be released at Sundance next year. We're really
How are you
going to
fill 29 minutes of material? I mean, I can give you a minute, but there's like 29 minutes of nothing.
seriously, though, this movie is all moralizing. It's just browbeating us with feminism in the trailer. This could be another marketing ploy, though, isn't this? This is just protecting it from any criticism by giving it this veil of, oh, it's a feminist pick. Could this just be the trailer makers? I mean, the movie could be completely different.
Yeah. Now, let's be fair about the trailer. It could just be a marketing thing, because I think the one thing in the trailer was the guy who tries to get her to cheat on Percy is just like, women can't write stories. And there's nothing else really in it to make it seem like this is a movie about a woman overcoming, correct?
I don't know. Even just the part of the trailer that isn't trying to preach to me, I'm not interested in Tackle.
Yeah, I just... I don't know. Just show me a trailer about a woman doing something cool. Like, that's all I care. I don't care. As long as the person is doing something cool, I'm in.
Agreed. And I think that puts a good button on it. And I think that puts a good button on our episode. So let's sum things up. What did we learn this trip? Daniel?
I learned that Democrats are very selfishly holding the keys to immortality away from women until they win elections, which is, that's pretty vile.
Well, it's not just women. Do they only know how to make women immortal, or could they make all of us immortal?
Well, I don't know. I only know that they can make women immortal. I don't know if the technology makes everyone immortal, or if you identify as a woman, you become immortal. I'm not sure. Is Bruce Jenner going to be immortal? I don't know.
I mean, Jenner's change makes sense now, if he's part of the Illuminati.
That's right. So I call on the Democratic Party today to release your immortality technology, otherwise you hate Mexicans.
William?
Well, I learned this week that I am so starved for quality sci-fi that I'm ready and willing to read almost anything into the shithole that is Anon.
Anon what? Did I ever tell you that story about my mother meeting Fiza for the first time?
Oh, God.
And my mother's from the Midwest. Grew up in Chicago, but not in any part of Chicago that had culture, apparently. And my mother asked if there's anything that Fiza would want first day. And so I was saying rice. And then I said, and naan. And my mother said, naan what? And I said, naan bread. And she said, what's not bread? We just talked past each other like who's on first for about 5 minutes. It was great.
That's a good one. I remember that story. That's one of the good ones.
Yeah. Yes, Fiza is one of the good ones. Justin, what did you learn this week?
I learned a lot about fluids. I learned that UTIs are common in space and why. And I also learned that there is no oil in Tesla vehicles. How do they flush out the toxins if they can't flush out the oil? That's an Adam Carolla reference for you.
That's right. Well, what did you learn this trip, Midsiders? Tell us what you thought about the show, about the stories, about the banter on the social medias. There's Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, Vero at the Midside, where you can leave Justin a private message or tweet or do whatever you want, make graphics out of it like Motive Power does, which we love. It makes me feel like a celebrity. It's incredible. You can also go to themidside.com/podcast and listen to all the previous shows with various hosts, including James. If you miss him, you can go back and reminisce about the old times with James. You can listen to all the episodes there. You can go to themidside.com/store and get some swag, i.e. t-shirts with the classic logo or the false dichotomy bro shirt, or of course the now famous Hail Snydra shirt over there at the store. You can also go to iTunes and Google Play and subscribe and get this show delivered immediately when it's published to the listening device of your choice. iPhone X, Android something or other, iPad, old-timey Zune, whatever it is that you're listening to this on, it'll be delivered automatically when you subscribe. While you're there, leave us a 5-star review. 5 stars, that's all the stars, filled in, not unfilled in. I know that 5 stars are still there even if you don't click on them, but they're gray. We need the gold stars, all filled in. And leave us a review. Helps us move up in the rankings, beat Welcome to Night Vale. Still don't know what it is. I think it's a radio show. Tried to tune in once. I was confused. I tuned out. And you can tell any number of your friends about the show. That helps. We also want to thank Liberty.me for syndicating us through their platform, Libertarianism Woo. And then Patreon.com/TheMidSide. Patreon is a platform for content creators, and it allows you to subscribe and agree to give us some money every time we do this show. $1, 50 cents, $2, $5, whatever it is, whatever you can afford. All of it helps. It helps what? Keep the lights on. That's what it helps. I'm sitting in a completely dark room doing this recording today. I need more lights on. I really do. I'm trying to buy a house. Houses in DC are expensive. I need all the Patreon money. I really do. So go to themidside.com/Patreon or patreon.com/themidside and subscribe today. You can't do that. That's fine. Money isn't cheap, as they say. It costs something. So if you don't have money, we still love you as long as you tell a friend about the show. Telling a friend is the number one way that this show grows and takes over the world, and we can witness more farce with more people. The response to the show is increasingly huge, Justin. I am sort of shocked all the time by the new people who reach out to us with Woker joke submissions or requests to co-host or their condolences about James getting cancer or any of the number of other things that have happened recently. I'm like, where are all these people coming from? People actually listen to the show. It's amazing.
I love how they reach out to you. Travels
into your ear. So they reach out to you too. I get the notifications on the Facebook page for people and their messages. But it's a good time. So thanks for that. Tell a friend, and until next time, I'll miss you.
I won't miss you, but I'm going to do the outro anyway. So this concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm your host, Justin Emblesneski, reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day.